This is the I Read Comic Books Podcast, episode 62. This week's episode was recorded on March 12th, 2016. On this week's episode, Paul Jaisley, Kate Scotchless, and our host, Mike Rappin, revisit Daredevil and the various creative teams that have told his stories. They touch on their favorite runs of the character and what makes those runs successful. They also chat a little bit about the Daredevil show, their issues with it, and their hopes for the upcoming season. All on this week's episode, which starts now.
This is the I Read Comic Books Podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two amazing people, Paul Jaisley.
Hello.
And Kate Scotchless.
Hey there.
Thank you both for joining me this week. I'm so excited to talk about comic books with you. And speaking of comic books, how have your weeks been and how have comic books been? What have you guys been reading?
Well, my week has been incredibly busy, so I wasn't able to read a ton, but luckily the quality of the books made up for the lack in quantity in my case. I caught up on Justice League. I read issues 47 and 48. I'd kind of fallen behind on that, but the Dark Side War is still raging. It's still a fun book. Jason Fabok is back on art, so I'm very curious to see how this whole story is going to wrap up in the next few months, now that it's going to be rebirthed at some point, I guess.
Are they dragging that series, like, are they dragging the event onto the end of the run?
I don't think so, because I think Johns is leaving the book after 50, so...
Oh, okay.
And then they just announced that the story is going to continue in, like, a one-shot, so I feel like they have to like add on another issue. Like maybe it would have been one issue more, but because they wanted 50 to be the breaking point, you know, maybe it was something like that. I'm not sure, but still fun. I'm still enjoying it. Black Widow number one, which I absolutely loved. Anytime an artist and a writer are willing to just do a 20-page action sequence and that's the issue, I love the audacity of that. And that's exactly what this was. We'll talk more about Wade and Chris Somni, I think, later in the episode. But this was definitely a continuation of what they did on Daredevil, and I absolutely loved it. Cry Havoc number two, I think I liked a lot more than the first issue, actually. I liked the first issue a lot, but issue two seemed like a better explanation of the hook. You know, of the series, and
totally. I
loved the annotations in the back, fleshing all that stuff out. I'm very excited for this series, and I'm glad issue two was even better than issue one for me. But the big thing I read this week, literally, was Patience, which is the new graphic novel by Daniel Klaus. So if you don't know who Daniel Klaus is, he's one of the biggest sort of most well-known names in American independent comics. He did a series in the 80s and 90s called 8-Ball, where he serialized Ghost World, which is probably his best-known story because it was made into a movie. And actually, the movie is probably the best adaptation of a comic into a film, in my opinion, because it really captures the tone of his comics perfectly. So if you've seen Ghost World, you kind of know what you're getting into when you're reading Daniel Klaus comics. They're sort of satirical, a lot of dry humor, characters that you're sympathetic with but also are not good people, you know, they're sort of off-putting in their personalities. Patience is his first book of new material in about 5 years, and you know, I'm just going to read the quote from the back of the book because it does a better job explaining it than I could possibly ever could. So Patience, a cosmic time warp death trip to the primordial infinite of everlasting love by Daniel Klaus. And that's exactly what the book is. It's a love story about a man whose pregnant wife is found murdered, and he basically waits until time travel is invented, and he goes back to try to stop it from happening. And it's about this sort of power of undying love. At the same time, it's very sort of crass and cynical. I don't know how else to explain it. I absolutely loved it. Daniel Klaus is one of my very favorite cartoonists, comic book creators of all time. I'm so happy that it's a new book out. And I just basically sat down last night and kind of read it start to finish and just was so enamored with it. So I don't know if I would recommend it to be your first Daniel Klaus book. I might recommend, if you haven't read Ghost World or David Boring, or maybe The Death Ray would be a better introduction. But this is a fantastic, fantastic book. So glad it's finally out in my hands and I was able to read it this week.
Very cool. Very cool. I feel like I remember you telling me that this book was coming out, and I've been meaning to go back and reread Ghost World and Death Ray since I read them a long, long, long time ago. But yeah, that sounds fantastic. Maybe I will eventually check that out. Kate, what did you read this week?
I've actually had a lot of reading time this week because I am dog sitting. So, you know, you go to the house with your pile of stuff and kick back. And so I have read... I read Thor number 5, and I actually dropped this from my pull list, so this is the last one I got. They had the interesting premise of Dr. Jane Foster being in chemotherapy and also being Thor, and then they kind of stopped caring about that premise and just went to her smashing stuff with the hammer for the next few issues, which, I mean, is good
Thor
stuff. But the part that made it interesting for me, I'm not a big Battle of the Week kind of fan. And the storyline was like, oh, should we trust Loki? Of course you shouldn't trust Loki. It's Loki. What are you, like, come on. And then, oh, big surprise. It doesn't work out well for anybody.
Oh, no.
Right? Spoiler alert, Loki tricks people.
Sorry.
So it stopped being something that I felt like throwing, you know, the Marvel prices at every month. So... And it also looks like the next arc, they're going to be going back to the former male Thor, which is less exciting.
What?
He's not worthy. Why do we care? So I dropped that, and reading number 5 kind of reaffirmed that for me. I was a little worried about it, and then I got the last issue and was like, yeah, I'm not that sad. It was pretty anticlimactic end to this arc. And then I read Vision number 5, which was as awesome as Vision always is. And we have confirmation that Tom King is staying with the title through the 12 issues it was originally slated for the story.
Oh, they're doing 12 issues of that book. I thought it was ending after 6.
Yeah. Mm-mm. They confirmed it's 12.
Wow.
He's doing the full maxi series or whatever. That was the deal when he went to DC, is he said he wanted to finish this. So that is exciting. And this one, it starts with like a montage of kind of what's going on, and with the voiceover of it being from the Merchant of Venice, you know, if you prick me, do I not bleed, and all this stuff, which is, of course, super relevant because his family doesn't bleed. that's kind of the problem. They don't fit in very well, being, you know, robots. But I can't talk much about it without spoiling stuff, but this series is amazing, and anyone who hasn't read it should.
I really want to. I'm probably going to grab this in oversized trade or something.
Yeah.
Or pick it up digitally.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I'm hoping that they come out with one of those nice shiny hardcovers for it once it has the complete series, and I can just get like the omnibus of it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm getting it in digital right now. So the other big thing for me was Snowblind this week. It finished. It's a 4-part miniseries, and so this was number 4. And I was super excited but also super sad to read it because I didn't want it to end. But it was just so perfect. Like, I guess the best way to explain how perfect this comic is like, you're opening on the scene of the cabin, and they're maybe being hunted. You're not really sure. And so the way they kind of get you in this mood, like, instantly from page one is they have, like, a zooming in on the cabin, and you realize frame by frame that your perspective is that of a wolf, and so you're seeing through the wolf's eyes. And so basically, like, they're being watched by a predator and kind of hunted, and then you go into the cabin, and there's this tense scene about, like, is this guy coming or not? What's happening? Do we really need to be here? And then, you know, it all builds from there. But it's just, like, simple, and it's so beautiful. It's all watercolors by Tyler Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
And so... It's perfect. And there's no right answers. The other thing I really love about this is your protagonist is this kid, Tyler, who's a teenager. And so often in these stories, whether it's in comics or books, you have these kids in these hard situations that then make all the right choices, which is kind of like come on, please. You're 15 and your world was just shattered and you're like doing everything right. Like, no.
Yeah, weren't you a perfect 15-year-old too? I mean, come on. Yeah.
Exactly, right? I want to read stuff that's not real as it. No, just kidding. So this kid is like in this really awful situation and is making mistakes and making good choices and bad choices and is very torn, and it shows in his actions, not just like an inner monologue, which is usually how they show it, and then they ultimately make all the right choices, which is just ugh. So it's just, yeah, it's heart-wrenching, and you feel for this kid and you can feel for him even more because it's like so realistic, you know what I mean? And there's no easy answers for him. So anyone who hasn't read this, I keep hunting to see if this is coming out in trade because there's so many people I keep telling to read this, and I have found nothing. And I've messaged Boom on Twitter about it, and they haven't responded. There was like one article in Bleeding Cool that kind of made reference to an upcoming trade, but not really, and there's nothing out there about it. So I don't know if this will actually get a trade or not. I hope it does, but you can get it in digital, so... Those are the highlights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the problem sometimes, I think, with Boom and their distribution schedule is that it takes them a little bit longer than, like, Marvel or DC to announce that they're going to do a, you know, a collected edition of something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think Giant Days, for instance, I think had a collected edition of 1-4, and that didn't actually come out until issue 9 or 10. So, oh, like, wow. We're looking at, like, almost 6 months, five, 6 months later before, you know, it's actually going to be released, which means you've got, like, a two-month lead on announcing when it's actually going to come out. So I would say give it maybe a month or two after the book finishes so that you can determine whether or not that's actually going to come out. And I think the other part of that is based on how well it's sold in single issues. But yeah. For the most part, I think at this point, like, Image, pretty much everyone that isn't Marvel and DC are soliciting all of their books in collected editions because those always sell better for them, like, especially indie books. So, I don't know.
Well, and I know has been just getting every time an issue comes out really great reviews on all the main sites, but when I actually go to shops, not a lot of shops are carrying it, so I would assume it's not actually selling that well. But I hope they come out with a nice edition. I would pay the extra bucks for one of those, you know, special collector's copies for this. It is beautiful and something I want to have on my shelf.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I was trying to Google it to see if, like, something had changed in the last, like, probably day since you looked it up. but yeah, so for me this week, I actually only had a chance to read two comics. They were floppy comics from a couple weeks back. I read The Dark Knight 3, number 3. Which is a continuation into Frank Miller and Brian Azzarello's madness, where Batman and Robin have decided that they need to help Superman. And I'm just gonna leave it there. The book is a wild mess, and yet I keep reading.
But
so,
you know, Mike, I had the same kind of reaction. It felt like not much happened in the actual issue, but I really, really enjoyed the mini comic.
I was going to say, the Green Lantern mini comic was, I think, more important to the story.
Yeah.
And I'm super glad that I read it after reading the actual comic, because I think that was their intention, was that you would read the main comic, then read the secondary comic, because the implications of that were fantastic. I don't know. I do like the story that they're going with in this whole book, and I don't want to spoil it, but I am kind of confused as to what Batman's place is in all of it. Like, from a greater DC universe standpoint, I'm really confused about where Batman fits into all of this. So how they tie things together will be really interesting.
It is interesting because it reminds me of when Frank Miller did Dark Knight Strikes Again, and most of the book is about the rest of the Justice League. Like, Batman doesn't have that big of a role in it till the last issue. And I feel this is kind of the same pace. It's like Batman's got to get everyone else on board for the plan to work. But
yeah,
that's a very classic Justice League story structure, though. So
But then call it Justice League, man.
Right, exactly.
Like,
that's
the thing. I want a story about this old disheveled Batman. Right. And we are only getting pieces. So nonetheless, I'm still reading it. I just felt a little off.
Sure.
By the main issue, and the Green Lantern mini comic was very good, like you said.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I read this week was Fight Club 2 number 9, and if I thought the Dark Knight 3 was confusing, this Fight Club 2, I think Chuck Palahniuk has lost his mind and has decided he doesn't know what he wants to do with this book. Like, the first 6 issues had a definite purpose and drive, and there was some nice meta moments, and the last 2 issues of Fight Club 2 have been more self-referential Tyler / Sebastian. They're calling Chuck Palahniuk, like, on the phone to figure out what's happening with the story, because the characters don't even know. And in some ways, I'm thinking, yeah, this is funny, this is clever. But in other ways, at the end of this issue, it's supposed to be concluded at issue 10. I have no clue where they could possibly take this book and have it make a semblance of sense.
Right.
I don't know. This is another book that I keep reading because I'm like, you've got to blow my mind with where you're going here. Otherwise, I'm going to be very mad at the world.
You know, I'm somewhat curious about this book because I love Cameron Stewart's art so much.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's tremendous. Yeah. But I have less than zero interest in Chuck Palahniuk as a writer. And it's like this thing, yeah. Like, I know I would love looking at this book, but not reading it. Like, maybe I could do that.
Yeah.
Just like block out all the dialogue and just look at it. You know,
what publisher is it?
Dark Horse.
Okay.
Actually. Yeah. It's a very strange book. I can say that. And yeah, Cameron Stewart's art, I think, definitely helps ease the reader into the story.
Sure.
So it's very attractive, but the story is very weird. I feel a lot of the same themes coming out of the book as I did out of Fight Club, the book, but really, this comic book feels like a sequel to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
I think that was what Chuck Palahniuk's intentions were with this book. So from a standpoint, I mean, I know that in interviews, and I could probably find it somewhere, Chuck Palahniuk has said that he, and please correct me if I'm wrong, anybody out there on the internet, I think he has said that the Fight Club movie was a more accurate representation of what he was trying to convey in the Fight Club book. So he prefers the story of the movie that he did not himself write over his actual work that the movie is based on, to which I'm like, that just blows my mind. And then this comic feels like a sequel to that. So,
well, I got to say, you know, I, as someone that was 18 when Fight Club the movie came out, as a, you know, an 18-year-old male, it spoke right to me. And
yeah.
I honestly couldn't finish the book. Like, I tried to read it and I was like, yeah, this is not my thing at all. So
the book is really hard, and I really enjoyed some of Palahniuk's work. Like in specific, I really enjoyed Lullaby and Diary, and Survivor is probably my favorite of all of them. But Fight Club to me has it like ends 3/4 of the way in to the book,
yeah,
and then the last quarter just feels like we need to fill up pages to get to an actual novel length,
right?
Which is really bizarre to me. So yeah, but anyways, Fight Club 9, what a weird book. What a weird comic. I think if you enjoy David Mack's art on cover and you enjoy, you know, Cameron Stewart's art and interiors, this will be a good book for you to read. If you're also okay with a very fucking confusing, strange, weird story where there's like preachy moments. I don't know. Maybe it's not for everybody. I'm going to take that back. Just, you know, if you like Fight Club, maybe you'll like this. You probably won't. So
that's the pull quote.
Best pitch I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah.
Well done.
So let's just move right along.
Shut it down.
What are you guys excited for this week? Kate, Paul, what are you guys looking forward to?
I am really excited for Huck number 5.
Really?
This book, I wasn't expecting to love it. I picked up the first one just kind of, I think I got it like a week or two late, and it was based on a review I read. And I was like, oh, okay, it's Image. I'll give it a shot. Because I frequently give them the benefit of the doubt. And it is really good. And number 4 ended on a fantastic twist, like one of those twists where you like gasp out loud and startle your dog that's just sitting there all peacefully with you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? So I am really excited to see where this is going now. And yeah, it's just really good. It's Mark Miller is writing it, and Albuquerque's on art. And it just, especially Albuquerque's art, he does such a good job with the facial expressions so that there's not so much of that telling inner monologue stuff. He just does it all through the face, and it's really beautiful. Yeah, I can't really talk about it much without spoiling stuff at this point, so I'm just going to stop there.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm just so surprised because number one only half sold me, and like I thought the concept was interesting, but I don't know if it's a book that I'd want to read long term. Like, is this is this an ongoing book or is it?
Yeah, no, it's an ongoing. And number one is all like warm and fuzzy, him just doing good things, and then you get into the whole, well, could this last? Of course it couldn't, because other people aren't perfect, and someone's going to want to profit off this, and where did this guy come from anyway? And yada yada. So, it gets much more into that, but then it's looking at like how would this very do-gooder type guy with these powers respond to that, and it's interesting. So it's definitely a lighter book.
What do I
do
with this superhero?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's just another example of an artist that I absolutely love working with a writer that I couldn't care less about. So, I mean, again, it looks lovely. I flipped through the first issue on the stands, but that Mark Millar is a name that I just cannot pony up the dollars to check out. So,
that's fair. I have people like that too, but I'm just gonna throw out there: it is a $10 trade when it comes out. So
yeah,
that's true, and it will end up at the library in a few months.
Exactly. Yeah, eventually it will be at the library. Yeah. Well, cool, Paul. What are you up to? What are you excited for this week?
Well, this is another very light week for me. There's not much coming out that's on my pull list or new stuff I'm interested in, but Martian Manhunter number 10 is out this week, and I've really been enjoying this series. I feel there's been some pacing issues, maybe. I think it started off really strong, and then issues like, you know, 4, 5, and 6 were a little bit slower. But the last couple issues I've really, really enjoyed. I like the sort of high concept of it that, you know, the Martian Manhunter, who's always been this sort of solid character in the DC universe, is suddenly, you know, learns about his past, and it radically changes his status as a superhero. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the main hook is that he had his personality split up into several different characters. And the book is about them working together to be the Martian Manhunter. And, you know, the last issue 9, sort of, you know, got back on pace for me, mainly because there was a giant robot battle on Mars. So
yeah, that was actually pretty cool.
Yeah, so I feel like this is one of those books that might not survive Rebirth, so I kind of want to make sure I see it through the end. And, you know, there's enough interesting stuff in it that even if there is sort of a slower issue, overall it's still a lot of fun to read.
So, wait, so did they have separate bodies, this version, aspects of his character, or is it just all internal?
No, it's different people around the world who suddenly realize that they're part of the Martian Manhunter's consciousness. Like one character is like his urges, like the part of him that loves Oreo cookies. That's like one person, one character.
Yeah.
Another character is like his warrior aspect, or his, you know, his manhunter. You know, he's an FBI agent. That's why he's an FBI agent, because he's the manhunter element. So it's a really clever twist on a character that usually seems kind of boring or dull. You know,
He's really one of those just stupidly overpowered.
I've always been partial to him, but I could see where people would think that. So
yeah. I feel about him the way I feel about Superman. I'm like, what's really the conflict here?
Let's not get into that, because I've got a lot of thoughts.
You have feelings? Okay.
I love Superman unconditionally. So yeah.
Paul, you definitely bring up a good point. I this book has constantly been on my will I drop it, will I, you know, keep reading it book, which ultimately usually means you should just drop a book. Like, if you're unsure about it, you should probably drop it. But after reading number 9, I'm like pulled right back into the story. There was something about the last issue that just fixed all of the problems, I think, like you said, the last 2 or 3 issues it had in terms of pacing and the direction even. Like, I mean, there was the whole bad guy element to it, and it's like, I'm gonna kill you, Martian Manhunter, if I have to destroy this world to do it. And That's classic, but it felt boring to me. Like, it wasn't, I don't think it was very well executed, but somehow issue 9 just fixed it. Maybe it was the giant robots.
I was going to say, so just throw in some giant fighting robots and you've got Mike back.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before we started, you know, recording today, I did buy 2 copies of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers number 1, and that show was full of giant robots.
There you go, yeah.
But anyways, that Martian Manhunter was not my pick this week. My pick actually is Injection number 8, because I can't get enough of this book, and I will continue to sing its praises until it ultimately ends. And I know that Warren Ellis has said on his newsletter that he's got plans out for the next year or two with that, or maybe 3 years. This might be his next big, I don't know, story that he's done, like a Transmet or an Authority or something like that. And I don't know, the issue 7 was pretty fantastic. We're like kind of starting a new direction in the story. This team of mysterious folks that we didn't really get as much insight into them as you'd think you'd get in the first arc of a series mm-hmm. is suddenly starting to come together, and you are actually getting more backstory. And it's less surface level. And I really enjoyed the one-off with the issue that I guess started this arc. Focusing on the British guy whose name I can't think, or the detective guy whose name I can't think of, who lives in New York, and he intentionally is given ham that is made of human meat, and the story goes from there, because it has to do with the cult stuff. And it's like, they're just like little moments of weirdness in this book that keep pulling me in and make me appreciate the story. And I don't know. I don't think I could easily sell this to somebody, but I think if I just gave you the first trade and said, sit down and don't ask any questions and just read this, you might actually end up liking it. Sure. It's a hard book to sell, I think, because the concept
What is even the premise?
The premise,
I guess I know nothing about this.
Okay. So the premise is not what you... There's the premise, like the what they pitched it as, and then there's the first arc, which is a completely different thing. And okay. which sounds ridiculous, but the idea is that there was this group of people that came together at one point and tried to basically create a new mythology in the world. Not like I guess deity or whatever, but they were trying to like create an artificial intelligence that would help them solve figure out like mysterious acts of folklore, right? So, you know, we hear about these things about like fairies in the woods, and there has to be a scientific explanation for everything, you know, because we live in the real world. So these people, I don't know, like, I feel like I'm telling it wrong, but they created this thing that they quote unquote injected into the world, and now it's coming back to haunt them. And this thing that they injected isn't really clearly defined, but it's like a super intelligence that is playing on our folklore to try to contact us. So,
launched Skynet, and Skynet is...
When I say they launched this thing, we don't actually really know what the thing is yet. Like, that's still being explained to us. So, there is some intelligence that is somehow out there in the ether of the world. Like, it exists between atoms or something. And it's using our folklore to try to communicate with us, because that's the only thing that it can, like, grasp onto.
It does sound really interesting.
It's a fucking bizarro story, and trying to read it month to month was almost a pain, because you needed way more context that you could get delivered in an entire graphic novel, or like an entire, you know, collected edition or a collected run. So I really hope that this book continues to sell, because I really want to see the completed story, but I don't know how to tell people to read this book without having them ask me questions like, wait, what's actually happening? What's this book actually about?
I'm pretty sure this was in a Humble Bundle I got from Image.
It might have been. You might have gotten the first 3 or 4 issues or something like that.
Well, I think I got the first trade. I have to look, but it was one that I knew nothing about, and so it wasn't the top of the list of the stuff I started reading when I got it.
Yeah, it's good. It's a serialized graphic novel, and I really don't like that idea. I really, said this a million times before.
Sure.
On this specific show, that, like, sometimes comics should just come out in a collected edition initially. They don't need to be serialized, but they do need to be serialized, because that's how this, you know, system works. Comics don't really do too well if they're sold as a collected edition. Even though, you know, you get books like Paul, like you mentioned, Patience. I don't think that came out serialized. That was a graphic novel. But yep. Fantagraphics is a whole different market.
I just checked. I have the first volume sitting here in my Image Humble Bundle.
You should read that and get back to me about it.
Okay, will do.
So, we're going to take a quick break before I go insane over trying to figure out what Injection actually is about and try to explain it to everyone. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some very iconic runs on the series Daredevil, because I'll explain exactly why we're doing that this week when we come back. So for this week's episode, Paul, Kate, and I decided a few weeks back that we were going to take another look at some of our favorite runs on the character Daredevil. And we wanted to sit here and basically talk today about why these specific runs were the best, because of the creative teams or because of maybe where the book was at the time or where the character was, or in my case, where the previous author had left the character because he decided to go on and do New Avengers like a jerk, Brian Michael Bendis. So... Paul and Kate, I know that you guys have your choice runs or choice, I know, creative teams that you had on these books or on this book. So, and for this character, so let's start with, you know, one of you telling us why your creative team is the best.
Well, you know, I have to say that, you know, if I were to pick one creative team for Daredevil, it's got to be Mark Waid and Chris Samnee, along with Matt Wilson on colors, because that was the book that really made me appreciate the character in a way I never had before. Daredevil's a character that I think I've always wanted to like, but I never read a lot when I was a kid because I was a DC kid through and through when I was younger. And by the time I was sort of getting back into comics, about a decade ago at this point, I was getting back into reading superhero comics regularly again. I feel that's right when Brian Michael Bendis was sort of ending his run or was about to end, and it had such high praise, you know, to his run. It was so well regarded that I was like, oh, maybe I should check out Daredevil, tried a few issues of that, quickly discovered that Brian Michael Bendis is not my cup of tea at all. And
blasphemy.
But, you know, I think what it is with Mark Waid and Chris Samnee and, you know, the other artists that Mark Waid worked with, I think Paulo Rivera was one of them and someone else whose name I'm blanking on. But Mark Waid is someone who's able to, I think, tell stories that are influenced by Silver Age superhero, you know, ideas in a contemporary way. And that resonates with me a lot more deeply than someone that's just doing grim and gritty type stuff. So I went and, you know, I read the Mark Waid stuff, and his tone of being able to mix the two, Silver Age contemporary storytelling, you know, is mirrored by Chris Samnee's art in this amazing way. He's someone that's able to have a very stylized take on superheroes that never distracts from the actual narrative story, if that makes sense. Like, you know Chris Samnee's art as soon as you see it, but it never feels flashy or just, look, I'm showing off. It always fits the tone of the book. And there was something about the way that they worked together to make Matt Murdock a character that obviously had a lot of skeletons in the closet, sometimes literally.
Yeah.
And but still had that sort of intrinsic goodness that I like in my superheroes, maybe because I've been reading superheroes since I was 2 years old. You know, I mean, I always like happy, you know, positive, optimistic superheroes. So,
and even you didn't want to read Hawk?
I didn't want to read Hawk. So, I mean, there's other issues to that. But,
yeah,
you know, so, I mean, admittedly, I've only read a handful of takes on Daredevil because so much of his history is dominated by this grim and gritty street level approach that's not always my cup of tea. I love the Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli Born Again, mainly because David Mazzucchelli is such an amazing artist. Mm-hmm. You know, having an artist like that match with a writer that I really like, and I think that's what Chris Samnee and Mark Waid were able to do. Samnee's obviously very influenced by Mazzucchelli. Mark Waid is, you know, established himself as that type of creator that does stories that I like. It clicked for me in a way that the other creative teams on Daredevil I've read in the past just didn't. So... That's my two cents.
You didn't want to get into the Frank Miller crazy, this is the darkest thing you've ever read comics?
You know, I have to admit, I've never read The Man Without Fear that he did with John Romita Jr. I've always meant to.
It's very good in a really just dark Frank Miller way. I mean, it's classic Frank Miller at that point.
And it's not that I don't like that stuff, because I love, you know, Dark Knight Returns, and I love Batman Year One. But at the same time, it's like, well, I've already read that stuff. You know what I mean? It's a guy in a red suit instead of a guy in a black suit. You know, it's to me,
this guy's always blind, that sort of thing. Though.
Like, isn't that a joke in Mark Waid's run? There's an issue where Daredevil like saves a school bus full of kids, and one of the kids goes, "Hey, look, it's Red Batman," which is like one of the funniest little jokes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. So that's what I think. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, okay. So I think, first of all, it's interesting. Like, as much as I want to argue with you, Waid and Bendis both won Eisners for their writing on Daredevil. So clearly they both did it really well.
Yeah.
It's just, what do you like? And it hits me when you say, like, you like your superheroes fundamentally good. And I'm like, oh, well, I am the exact opposite. I find it much more interesting when they're pretty broken people with these powers and trying to wrestle with their own demons and figure out balances between. So I really like the runs where Daredevil's trying to walk the line between what's the right thing to do and what is the thing that feels good to do. And my favorite arc is with Bendis and Mac, the first arc of Bendis's run. And in the like first or second issue, there's this thing that, what's his name? The reporter, Ben, I think it is.
Ben Urich.
And he's like,
he's one of the best characters in the Marvel Universe, hands down.
I totally agree.
That is not a superhero.
So he says, "When do you know which side is the best side to be on, Matt? And how many times is he right? And what happens when he isn't?" And that kind of sets the tone for the whole thing, the whole arc. And it's just, oh, it's so perfect. But also talking about art, like Mac's art is fantastic in a way that then from there we went to Maliv's art, and Maliv obviously is really good, but Mac does his art in a way that he incorporates in the art what Daredevil's hearing, and so it doesn't need to be in the, you know, the voiceover boxes, which really cleans up and makes more interesting the comic and makes it a better read, I think. And that is one of, besides the fact that they're each beautiful pieces of art you could hang on your wall, that I really makes it for me in the art with Daredevil for him.
I mean, I think that's interesting because Daredevil is such a visually striking character that you have to have an artist that's able to do that, to set up these amazing action sequences and also demonstrate his powers. And I think that
absolutely
Mark Waid's run, I mean, especially the stuff with Paulo Rivera, I mean, they went to great lengths to really show this is what his powers are like to him and put you, you know, behind the mask in that sense. And I think it's really important to this character specifically to do that.
Yeah, it's so hard. Like, how do you show sound? And it's interesting to see all these different artists take on that. And some of them don't even deal with it at all. In Maliv's arc that comes after Max, it's all in boxes. This is what I'm hearing, like the clips of sound. And the colorist does some work with it that helps more distinguish what he's hearing and, you know, the radar-y type stuff versus the normal, but it's very much done through words versus the visual. And yeah, I guess I prefer the visual. What about you, Mike?
Yeah. Oh, man. See, the reason...
First of all, do you like him broken or superhero?
I actually like Daredevil when he's not Daredevil. I like Matt Murdock's struggle. Like his struggles as a person trying to balance his superheroics with being like a lawyer, because I think in both ways he's very important to the community that he works in, which is like the whole focus of his character. Like, he needs to save the neighborhood and he can do it in two ways. And my pick for, you know, who I thought what creative team did the story, but the best was, I think, Ed Brubaker and Michael Lark's run that they did. Which is followed right after Bendis's run. And Bendis's run is actually fantastic Bendis builds the whole story up to, I haven't read all of it, but I've read a large chunk of it. It builds the story up to Daredevil going to jail, or Matt Murdock going to jail for essentially being Daredevil. Yeah. And like, no one can really prove it, but at the same time, they have they have a definite doubt that Matt Murdock is like and Daredevil are the same person, I guess. Or they have no doubt that he's the same person. So,
well, but they almost instantly do, because then someone else puts on the suit and kind of confuses things.
What makes things interesting about Brubaker's run is that immediately, as soon as Matt Murdock goes to jail, people start seeing Daredevil on the streets again. And throughout the story, we actually learn who that is. And I'm going to spoil it here, because if you haven't read this, I'm sorry. But it actually turns out to be Danny Rand, Iron Fist. And and it was because of this run that I found myself interested in Danny Rand, which led me to read other books involving Danny Rand, specifically The Immortal Iron Fist, which is the run that Matt Fraction, Ed Brubaker, and David Aja did. Ranted about it before, but that's one of the best Iron Fist books you can ever read. Imagine Hawkeye, but it's about Iron Fist, and a little less, a little less goofy, but nonetheless.
I need to go find
back
this.
You should. It's two volumes. They're two oversized volumes out there. Fraction and Brubaker absolutely kill it, and David Aja's art is, phenomenal. So
how did you come to Daredevil in the first place? What started you?
So with this run, I was actually gifted it. Like, a friend of mine had been reading Daredevil for all of Bendis's run, and he was like, here, they're starting a new run. Here's a collected edition of the first one. And so he gave me Brubaker's run, and it wasn't labeled volume one, but it was like, here's a good jumping on point. As someone who had been reading it for a long time, he knew that this was going to be a good spot. And I had some questions about who Ben Urich was and who Foggy was, but it was enough to I knew who Daredevil was, because this is the reason why I like this arc. I like this creative team, is because they tried to do less Daredevil stuff, and instead it was more about Matt Murdock trying to solve his life's problems. And I love the whole, the place that they put Foggy Nelson in, where he's, Ben Urich is in the first issue of their run. Ben Urich comes to Foggy Nelson and he goes, what side of this are you going to be on? Like, you can either help Matt and get him out of jail and tell him to stop doing this thing, or you're going to help this vigilante and pretty much just, be on an unethical lawyer. And so, I don't know. I love the way
you can't put him on the stand to testify that he's not Daredevil when you know he's Daredevil.
That's the prompt that this whole run has for a while. And I don't know. It's one of my favorites. I read this, and then I stopped reading Daredevil, and I started picking it up again to read the last bits of this arc, because I was like, oh, Ed Brubaker, and. I'm realizing I told you guys a different story earlier because I'm remembering it differently now. But I started with Ed Brubaker's run, but I started at the end. That's what it was. I got the last trade of this run. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to keep reading it. And then it turns out there was a new creative team with Andy Diggle and blah, blah, blah. And I went back and reread all the Brubaker stuff. But anyways, so that's how I got introduced to all of it. And I don't know. I love that run because it wasn't about the super heroics. It was all about Matt Murdock being person torn between two worlds, and it didn't have to do with the hand. It didn't have to do with anything crazy mystical.
Tons
with Elektra,
ninjas and stuff.
It's just about basics of who this character is, and it was constantly asking the question who do you want to be, Matt Murdock? Do you want to be Daredevil, or do you want to be Matt Murdock? And I love that about that run.
Well, and who are you fundamentally? That's again, it's where I like where he's walking this line between vigilante justice, it's how right is it? It's, I don't know, crossing that line.
Yeah.
Which is a gray area. So I actually came to it through, this is shameful. Remember that awful Elektra movie in the early 2000s?
They did an Elektra? Oh, they did do an Elektra.
They did, with Jennifer Garner.
Oh, man.
This was, so first of all, put yourself, here's Kate, I'm 14 or 15, and Alias is really popular on TV. And I'm
Jennifer Garner, yes.
So into it. You don't understand. I spend my time in class writing fan fiction and passing it off in the halls to my friend who's also obsessed with this show. And as the show goes downhill season by season, our fan fiction becomes parody fan fiction. And anyway, so here I am obsessed with the show and Jennifer Garner, and they make an Elektra movie. So I go see it because it's Jennifer Garner. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. It's basically her doing the same thing, but in a different universe as she did in the show, punching stuff in awesome ways. And so that's how I got interested in Daredevil a little bit. And then I saw it at the library and pulled it. And this is the first time I've admitted this to anyone. So wow. I came to Daredevil through the awful Electro movie.
Thanks, Jennifer Garner.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sincerely, yeah. From the bottom of my heart. Also, I have some things you should read.
Actually, if we're going to be talking about Ed Brubaker and Daredevil, I will say that there was a podcast episode of, I think, Comedy Bang Bang that I listened to, where mm-hmm. Ed Brubaker defends the director's cut of Daredevil and says that it's actually a very, very good movie.
So bad. No.
No. Hear me out. Because the director's cut of that movie keeps all the lawyer stuff that's in the book, that was in the original cut of the movie. So you actually see Matt Murdock be a good detective or good lawyer, as well as be Daredevil constantly being torn as a character, like in his run.
Oh, and they just cut it horribly.
And they cut it, yeah, and it's awful. So if you get a chance and find a DVD or Blu-ray copy or whatever of the director's cut of the movie, it's actually pretty good. So. Just got to say, I mean, Ed Brubaker defends it, and he's a fantastic author.
So we have this on record.
You should trust.
Mike Rapin likes the Daredevil movie. Okay, moving on.
Hey, I like Mike Rapin likes the Daredevil director's cut. Okay, leave me alone.
Mm-hmm. No, we this is, haven't you been in our society in this decade? This is all about sound bites. We're going to cut it in ways. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So,
the other thing that I know that we wanted to talk about. So, what makes these runs in specific, like, I guess, better than others? Like, why would you recommend your run over something else? And maybe even if you haven't read these, the other runs, I mean, what made the run that you've picked or the creative team that you've picked so much better, I guess, in your mind?
I mean, I think for me, I was immediately attracted to the visual style of the artist that Mark Waid worked with on his run. I think that Daredevil is a character that can do several different things. I just feel like for the past, 30 years or whatever, he was dominated by that Frank Miller, grim and gritty, fighting ninjas all the time thing. So having a different take on it is really appealing. And this was about as different as you could get. At the same time, despite the sort of bright colors and sort of more, I don't want to say retro, but maybe like not as detailed art, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. the more superheroic type of art. At the same time, Waid was able to draw out these sort of underlying threads and subtexts and narratives that hinted at, Matt Murdock might be choosing to be more positive and optimistic, but his past is still going to come back and haunt him from time to time. He can't always escape it. I thought the fact that Wade's run was so long, he was able to really play with both elements of the character without fully committing or fully being stuck with one. It wasn't all grim and gritty girlfriends being murdered type stuff. Yeah. And it wasn't all sunshine and lollipops either. It was a nice mix of both.
Yeah.
And I think he did a really nice job of playing with the underlying theme of the character, that he is interested in law and order, but he realizes that that doesn't cover everything. There is a role for vigilantism as well, and him trying to walk that fine line. Waid is a writer that I think can balance all this stuff really well and also appeal to me as sort of an old school superhero fan who likes, his heroes to be optimistic like that. So the icing on the cake, of course, is Chris Samnee's just mind-blowingly beautiful, appealing artwork as well. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That's why it's the best.
Well, it's so funny that you say that, because I think near the end of Brubaker's run and going into Andy Diggle's run that followed it on Daredevil and that same, story, there was so much reliance on the hand as a exactly. centerpiece of the story of Daredevil's estranged ex-wife and like crazy girlfriend. Like, they were purposely just like torturing this woman as part of the story to say, Daredevil, you look at how fucking terrible you've been. You've done all these bad things to all these people, and look who's paying the price. It's like, I think there were ways that they could have accomplished that by, other than just saying, look at all these damaged people in your life. And I know that's kind of the the MO of the superhero. You know, you want to do all these things and then people come after your family or be, you know, results of you saving 100, one person is damaged. But like that became the focus of the story near the end of Brubaker's run, or maybe that was the beginning of Diggle's run. And it kind of just, it felt really, really repetitive. And I know that I read all of Andy Diggle's run all the way through the Hand because I was kind of hoping maybe it'll get better. And it just became all about the mystics and the crazy, like, other side, the more, I don't know, fantastical side of Daredevil, and not so much about him being a person, like the Brubaker and it sounds like the Bendis run, where it was more about him as a lawyer, him as a superhero vigilante. So,
yeah, there's definitely runs on Daredevil where the Hand gets very like, oh, what were the ninjas and the Ninja Turtles? Where you just have
the
these
Foot Clan.
The Foot Clan, right? This
well,
just,
they are.
This,
they're just like ghost
disposable
people that turn into
automatons. Yeah.
Yeah. When they die, they quote unquote die because, you know, the superheroes don't kill anybody. But when they they turn into mist, I say in heavy quotes. But those guys are
just
dead.
Kind
those
of silly.
They're dead.
It doesn't matter. So Ben at the start of Bendis's run, his first arc was with Mac, and it's actually from Ben Ulrich's perspective, and he's writing the story.
What?
And he,
that's
yeah, so, no,
that's so dope.
You have to read this. Okay, so he is doing this story on this little boy who's like 6 years old, I think, and is just horribly traumatized and clearly saw something bad involving Daredevil. And what I love about this is there's so many runs where you have Daredevil walking that line and trying to figure out, you know, what's right and what's wrong kind of thing. But this one, it's from Ben's perspective, and it's going, did he go too far? And you really suspect, and I'm not going to spoil it because maybe he did or didn't, you know, but did he go across this line? And is this kid, did this kid witness something where Matt just went overboard kind of thing, and let his emotions and what felt good take control versus doing what was actually right? And so it's, So with Mac's art, he does so much in the art to so that it doesn't have to happen in the writing. So like this great example is as he's pursuing the story, no one wants him to pursue it. His editor doesn't want him to do it because Kingpin is currently on trial. So that's the big story he's supposed to be covering. But he feels that this story about this kid is more important, especially if it means something about what Daredevil's become. And so he's pursuing the story even though he's not supposed to, and he's talking to this kid who's really traumatized, this whole family, and the cops don't really care because this kid is the son of a villain, and so who cares that this villain's disappeared, you know, good riddance. And who cares about this mourning wife because, you know, she was married to this jerk and stood, you know, protected him by lying for him and stuff. So he's doing all this kind of feeling really isolated, and there's this scene where he's at this kitchen table with his family, his son and his wife, and he is in the, you know, the normal Mac style, the very artistic, you know, sketch detailed portrait, realistic, and his wife and child are both like caricatures, like line caricatures, and it's so good at just showing how isolated from them and distance he feels and how far away he is as a person from them. Like, he's in the room and sitting there with them and kind of talking to them, and yet there are these people that are so surface level he can't understand and relate to them at all. And that's all completely done through the art. Like, there's barely any words on these pages in the scene, and yet you get that really intense feeling of isolation and do I keep going with this when it's taking me away from everyone and everything I love? Like, everything's saying no, but it feels so important. And that was really powerful. This is also one of the few comic stories that has made me just straight up bawl. Like, I'm not a crier. I don't cry at sad movies. But oh my gosh, like, the feels. It is really powerful.
Wow.
And it has some really good twists and turns. And yeah, it is really good. So there's that.
Well, yeah, and I've heard that it's like that's one of the most iconic runs of,
oh, yeah,
of Daredevil.
They got a ton of awards for it. For just being spectacular, but
yeah. Well, I can all I can say, I mean, I feel like I've already explained why I like the Brubaker run. And I think that coming out of spinning out of the Bendis room probably means that I cheated a little bit this week, seeing that Kate and I were pretty much going to be arguing the same thing, or you know, for why we like those books.
Whatever, we're allowed to agree.
Yeah, and absolutely. So I think if you're going to read Daredevil, I mean, you should read all of the Bendis and you know, Maleev run, and then all of the Brubaker and Lark run, and you'll get yourself about 120 issues into Daredevil, and that's about all you'll need. And then take a break, and then read this the Wade and Samnee run, and you'll get out of your depression, and everything will be okay.
That's right. You'll feel better the world.
Yeah. So one thing that go ahead, Paul.
Are you excited at all for season two of Daredevil? And are you looking for a different shift in tone for that, the Netflix series?
Oh, man. I tried to watch that show. I watched, I think, an episode and a half, and it didn't get my interest at all. And it's one of those superhero shows where everything's so dark, and I'm like, I get it. You're feeling moody. We get it.
So did you not like Jessica Jones either?
Jessica Jones is awesome.
Hold on a second.
Totally different. Totally different.
No, Jessica Jones to me was darker than Daredevil.
Yeah, but it was darker in a good, interesting way versus I have feelings.
Oh.
Okay.
I mean, I'm excited for season two, but I'm really, really wondering how they're ever going to dig themselves out of this pit of darkness that they've put themselves in.
They didn't even once use the line "justice is blind," so that right there does it for me.
Yeah, that really should have been like the log line for the show.
Exactly.
Like that should have used it in all the promotions. Yep. It should have just been giant posters of Daredevil with "justice is blind."
Exactly. How did they not use that? Okay.
I mean, I am looking forward to season two, though. I do like how season one wrapped itself up and closed enough doors and opened enough windows.
It's this week.
Oh.
Yeah. Comes out on the 18th. Yeah. So after this episode airs.
Timely.
Yeah.
Timely. You know, I got to say, I thought season one started off very strong. I feel like it didn't need to be 13 episodes. I feel the same way about Jessica Jones well.
Yep,
I think you agree. You know, it was way too long. And, you know, again, and just like the comics, as soon as a stick and the hand show up, I just completely lose interest. But, but I, as much as I don't like the Punisher as a character, the fact that he's showing up is oddly intriguing to me. So we'll see. I do think it's funny, though, that the long-standing joke that DC movies are completely joyless and Marvel movies are fun is complicated by the fact that there is nothing less funny than Daredevil or Jessica Jones.
That is very true.
They're the most joyless superhero TV shows I've ever seen. So
even the moments of lightheartedness that are very, very few and far between are totally overshadowed, just blotted out by the brooding and darkness of the overall story.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's so dark. That's all I can think of. I mean, I just hope that the Luke Cage show is like just happy rainbows and good times.
Oh, you know it's not gonna
it's
be.
It's so not going to be.
Not even close. See, the reason I really like the Jessica Jones, and I agree that they could have cut a lot of fat from it. But I really like characters that are really damaged people trying to work out their issues and also be superheroes and that kind of struggle. And that obviously is Jessica Jones to the T.
You're telling me that you don't like to watch a show about guilty Catholics? Come on, that was all Daredevil.
I don't think I got to that part.
Guilty feeling Catholics. Sorry, that's not guilty Catholics. That sounds like a weird...
Anyways. Got enough of that in my childhood, thanks.
Well, I mean, okay, yeah. Show aside, but back to comics, if you guys don't mind. As far as, you know, from these Daredevil books, have either of you, like I kind of mentioned it earlier, like have you read other things? Like have these Daredevil runs led you to read other books that you probably maybe wouldn't have checked out? I mean, I ended up reading Immortal Iron Fist because of, you know, Immortal Iron Fist being the Daredevil, I guess, like alternative in the story. And I absolutely fell in love with the character. And now I just love reading Iron Fist stories. Has it happened to either of you because of these Daredevil runs? Have you like followed the creative team or maybe a writer or artist or anything?
Well, it made me pick up the first issue of Black Widow, which I mentioned earlier in the show. I mean, the reason I picked that up is because of what Mark Waid and Chris Samnee did with Daredevil.
Yeah.
If it hadn't been that creative team, I never would have picked up that book. Even though it's a character I might have been interested in, there's something about that team working together. And the fact that you can tell everything that they sort of learned with working on Daredevil, they brought to this character and even kicked it up a notch. I mean, that first issue, it's kind of just Mark Waid, the first issue of Black Widow, is kind of just Mark Waid saying, I'm just going to let Chris do his thing for 20 pages. And even in those 20 pages, even though it's one long action sequence, you learn a ton about the character just in the little moments and, you know, her stance. The things that happen in that action sequence actually will, I think, later on pay off in the story. So it really is about watching these two, I think, masters of comic book storytelling work on a character that I maybe normally wouldn't have been interested in. On the other hand, I kind of know I don't really need to check out anything else by Brian Michael Bendis because I didn't like the stuff that I read. So it's kind of the opposite. It's just not my thing. Thing at all. So if you like comics where all the characters talk in exactly the same voice and cadence, be my guest. But
yeah, no, you have a point there.
Wow.
And the ones that are distinctive are like caricature-y distinctive. You are not wrong. I love Bendis, but that is a flaw. I went to Electro Assassin by Frank Miller after reading my first Daredevil.
Oh, wow.
Which I'm not sure that Daredevil actually led me to it because, like I said, the movie is what got me there in the first place. But that was the next thing I found, and I really liked it. It has problems, obviously. It has one of my pet peeve things where you have women fighting in essentially underwear and thigh-high boots, and you're like, how is that even possible? No one would do this. But again, it's one of these broken characters trying to figure themselves out. I guess we're sensing a theme, and maybe I have a therapist I should talk to about this. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, so, and then I read some really, really bad Elektra trades and Daredevil trades and got off of it for a while because I was just grabbing things from the library, and like we've mentioned, there's some that are just dumb. Well, they're the battle of the week kind of thing. Like, now it's the bigger, badder boss who I have to fight. And I'm like, oh
Dragon
no.
Ball Z. Dragon Ball
yeah,
Z.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And yeah, that's what we have manga for. We don't need comics for that.
Right. Right.
But we do it in comics all the time. But okay.
I know.
So but okay, so what I guess what I'm getting at here, I guess, is you know, is Daredevil the type of story that where you can like branch off and maybe read something else that's similar and enjoy it, or is it like usually Daredevil stories are just Daredevil stories and there's nothing else to them?
I think they're pretty Daredevil stories. I mean, he's a part of the Marvel universe, but he has his own kind of set cast of characters that he interacts with that are pretty separate from, you know, the Avengers-y type people, at least in the books I've read. You know, he's with Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and those guys. And while the other ones are mentioned, in Spidey, which always seems weird in that universe because it's all dark and moody, and then there's Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's usually the beacon of light when he shows up. If only... what's really interesting is I always found that, you know, and this is something that I think, you know, a million people have pointed out, but, you know, Daredevil only interacts with street-level heroes.
Yeah.
You know, heroes like Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Jessica Jones, Misty Knight, and the list goes on and on. Spider-Man, obviously. And I think that's so funny because when he does get drafted into these bigger events, he's really useless. And it's so funny, but he's such an iconic, a great, like, well-loved character. But as soon as you take him out of his element, he is an awful character to work with.
Well, he's like any of the other hand-to-hand non-superpower. Well, like, he has powers, but not, like, superpowers.
Right,
like,
but Spider-Man
the same
still works
people
as
have
an
of,
Avenger,
like, Black
somehow.
Widow and... does he though? Does he?
Yeah,
really?
But your question, you know, but does Black Widow even work then? As an Avenger?
Like Black Widow and Hawkeye, I think are the most interesting characters on the Avengers. But when you like sit down and have a talk about it, there's really no defense for them being there. They're just like,
right?
I shoot arrows. Like
I'm super.
Why
sneaky.
Am I? Why am I here? You guys have totally got this under control.
Hold on. I want to take the audio from this, and I want to do a whole play, like a 3-minute play with Kate doing all the voices of all these characters.
That sounds like a really bad idea.
But this look at Daredevil is interesting because I think that his stories work really, really well. But as you know, what I was getting at was that I don't think he works outside of his element, like a lot of other characters. Right. Tony Stark can be a very dynamic character, or even a Batman can be a dynamic character. I think he works in multiple situations. But as soon as you take them out of if you take them out of their element, they still work as characters. Whereas with Daredevil or even like Luke Cage or Jessica Jones, like, their stories are very specific to that alleyway that they work in. And anything else is kind of hard.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, speaking of the Mark Waid run, I mean, a large chunk of the latter half of his run is Daredevil going to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the underlying theme is that he just doesn't fit. You know what I mean? As much as he tries to change and run away from his past, in a sense, he just doesn't fit outside of Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting
thing. He's a creature of his environment and is very much a product of it, and it's very much a part of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like when Batman's not in Gotham and you're like...
It's fine when he's on the Justice League moon. When he's with the Justice League, he's fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
I can understand.
Different. Yeah. I mean, it still works, but it's a different version of Batman.
Yeah, because Batman's the greatest literary character in history, and he fits in every type of story.
Or so DC would want us to think.
I think it's true. I mean, that's a whole other topic. It's funny you bring that up, Mike, because this idea of a creative team is what draws you to the character, or even the story, is really fascinating to me, because there are certain characters that no matter who's writing them, I'm going to have a hard time checking them out.
Yeah.
Like what?
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Like who?
Iron Man. There is literally nothing interesting about Iron Man.
Okay.
To me.
I feel the same way. I feel the same way about some characters, too.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, there are characters that's the case. I mean, Daredevil for a long time was one for me, and it took a right creative team to make it work. She-Hulk is one of my favorite Marvel characters, and it wasn't until I read the Charles Soule series that came out a few years ago that I really got it. I was like, oh, wait, this character is amazing. There was nuance there that I just assumed didn't exist because I had a superficial, understanding of Jennifer Walters. Mm-hmm. Being a through and through DC fan as a kid, there's a lot of Marvel characters. I'm just like, who cares? You know, and then, Kate, you talking about the Vision... There's literally nothing about the Vision that ever seems interesting to me, but you describing that new series, I'm going to have to check that out.
The Vision, I read this, it was the most boring character. Yeah, and right? It's completely, so the right writer can take basically any character. There's certain people that are so talented, I think, that they can find the story that's interesting in any of these people.
Yeah, and those people's names are Mark Waid, I think.
Well, is that the word we're going for? Okay.
Yeah. I think there are writers that I'll follow anywhere. Mike, please forgive me. I've long had no interest in the X-Men at all.
Yeah, I know.
But, I did read Grant Morrison's run. I know. I read Grant Morrison's run, and I absolutely loved it because, it's Grant Morrison. Mm-hmm. And I think he was able to really do a lot of interesting things with those characters that, as far as I understand, the writers that came after him completely ignored.
Well, but they ignored, and then eventually Marvel realized, oh wait, those were some really good things. Let's bring them back, but we're not gonna credit them. We're just gonna say, oh, this is how it had always been. We just chose not to acknowledge it, which is exactly what they did with a lot of his run. As unfortunate as that is, but
interesting.
That's a whole different topic. That's a whole different topic.
Whole different topic.
But I'm glad that we actually sat down and did this. I haven't sat down and tried to read an old Daredevil book in a while, and the new Daredevil series was doing it for me, and then it absolutely took a 90-degree turn, and I've lost interest in it.
Oh, I only read the first issue and was not...
Yeah, well, they immediately jumped to the Hand. I like the idea of... So if you haven't read if you haven't been listening to this show / haven't been, reading the new Daredevil series, we might be spoiling some things, but... I really did like the idea of Ten Fingers, right? I liked, or whatever his name was, right?
Yeah.
You know, I like the idea of, like, there's, ooh, this weird mystical thing. And then it fucking turns out to be the same mystical shit that it's always been. Like, come on, man. I'm okay with them doing some mystical stuff when they're also balancing it with, like, the lawyer stuff and Daredevil fighting with how he needs to act and what he needs to do for the city. But then they just, they defaulted back to the hand and it just lost all of its luster for me. So I'm guessing that that's probably because they're trying to be like, let's do a Daredevil book that has the hand in it, because that's going to be really important in this new TV show that happens to be coming out very soon.
So, right. Yeah.
Do we know how much, like, have any of the creators talked about what the interaction is between the show writers and comic writers? Like, how much direction they're given for what Marvel wants to see and...
Well, with Jessica Jones, Bendis's story was, like, ripped from the pages, from my understanding. I haven't read it. I haven't read Alias. I own all of it, but I haven't actually read it. But the story is, from friends that I know that have read the story, they said that it's very, very close to the source material. So, outside of Nuke, I don't think Nuke was in the book.
But I mean, like, the current ones, like, stuff that's ongoing. Yeah. I'm wondering how, like, with Daredevil, where both are ongoing right now with the comics and the show, like, what are they, I wonder how much interaction and direction there is there.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is dictated by the editors and not the creators themselves.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
I gotta say, it always kind of bugs me when I'm reading Marvel books and they draw Captain America's suit to look just like the one in the movie. I'm like, guys, I know, come on, it's different.
Yeah.
It can be different.
Or suddenly colors, Iron Man's face looks like Robert Downey Jr. And you're like, wait a minute.
yeah. Oh, well. But I mean, I think what's really interesting is you should see, just keep track of the credits when you're watching these shows. And you'll maybe notice a few comic book creators in the credits as consultants, or in some cases like Mark Guggenheim, who is the I think he is he's a producer on Arrow and Flash, and I'm so happy because his comics are pretty okay, but at least like there's a comic book person who I've read good comics, you know, from, involved in these shows, and maybe that's part of the reason why they're so good, because they're like, well, here's how we do it in the comics. And
this might be off topic, but I remember hearing that Mark Guggenheim had always wanted to be involved in television production at some point.
Yeah, so that doesn't surprise me.
He had his
me.
Career in comic books, and eventually I think this is what he would have rather been doing. Not that, maybe not rather be doing, but this is what always his goal at some point was to work on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to say, The Flash is arguably the second greatest superhero television show of all time. So there you go.
With the first being Batman, the animated TV series?
No, Batman from Adam West, 1966 Batman.
Gosh, I watched, I got through two episodes of Flash and called it quits.
That's
too bad, Kate.
Right up my alley.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
it's too bad. It's very wonderful. I love it to death. And Arrow. Yeah. I'm a sucker for those two shows.
I also got through like two, I think I did the full three episode.
Arrow is tougher because it's very CW.
Well, and after I did my three episode rule thing and then called it quits, my friend's like, oh no, well, you have to keep watching because it gets good like halfway through season two. And I'm like, that's like 20 some episodes away. That's like when people say you should read the Dresden Files, it gets good in book five. I'm like, I'm not going to read four books just to get to the good part.
Hold
like,
on a second, but you should read the Dresden Files. That's not related to what we're doing. You should read all of them. Kate, you will not be disappointed.
Okay. I'm easier to persuade to get to read stuff than to watch stuff. So
okay.
You might have me there.
But it's funny because I feel like that's not uncommon. I mean, reading a comic book takes 10, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot easier than watching an hour-long TV show. I've only watched three episodes of Arrow, one from each season, and it never worked for me.
Yeah.
So
only the crossover episodes?
Yeah. They're too soap opera-y.
I do watch those, yeah.
Okay.
And this isn't a criticism. It's just something I've noticed. It's like, once Ra's al Ghul shows up on Arrow, you're like, okay, you really just wanted to make a Batman TV show but couldn't.
Oh, right? Batman, basically Flash and Arrow are Batman and Superman. That is...
Yep.
I mean, sorry.
But,
Superman,
I mean, Supergirl
and
is Superman. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So. Supergirl is Superman, actually. And I actually do have to credit the team on that show for doing a pretty good job with it. I haven't seen all of it, but I've seen a lot of it. And
I haven't seen any. Like it.
Now the Flash can be the Flash. He doesn't have to be the hope that we need, as Oliver Queen told him a long time ago. He can just be Flash, and it's great. And he can go through other worlds and travel through time and do all the crazy, goofy comic book shit that everyone knows and loves him for.
That's what I love. I mean, that's what I love. I got to say, obviously, I love Batman unconditionally, but the Flash has always kind of been the secondary character, or the character that you'd want to be. There's a weird sort of power fantasy with the Flash, where it's like, if we could have any superpower, I'd want to be the Flash.
Yeah, so yeah.
That's as long as I, even when I was a kid, when the first Flash TV show was on in like 91 or 92, I felt the same way. Huh. So.
See, Flash, for me, as a standalone, doesn't work. I like him in team books, especially when it's like him and, is it him and Spider-Man that are usually the like quippy duo?
Flash and Spider-Man?
Wait, you mean...
not Spider-Man.
Green Lantern?
Oh my gosh, yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Green Lantern is the Spider-Man of the DC Universe? Is that
you guys.
No, sorry, I just... But he works well in
interaction with other... I was still thinking about... Spider-Man and our Daredevil. Anyway, sure. But yeah, no, they're like kind of the comedic relief in a lot of the teams, and I like him in that, but he doesn't, as a standalone, work that well for me.
Well,
I've never read a Flash comic book before. So,
okay, so I'm going to recommend a Flash comic.
Okay.
And it might not be the best Flash comic, but it's the most fun Flash comic, and that's The Trial of the Flash. This is... sort of like mid-80s Flash. Art by Carmine Infantino. And I think Carrie Bates is writing it at this point. This is the craziest goddamn comic I've ever read.
I've only read New 52 Flash, so this sounds more interesting. You're going to have to check this stuff out.
So it's Barry Allen. He gets charged with the murder of the Reverse Flash. He has to run away. He goes to Gorilla City. There is time-traveling jury tampering going on.
What?
It is the craziest fucking comic. Amazing. I'm not even scratching the surface.
And we all already know that we all love the courtroom superhero dramas. So.
Yeah, we
there we go. Especially when the writer has no understanding of the American legal system. It makes it much more entertaining.
Okay, I will try to find a copy of this and read it. If anything, I will grab it digitally.
Dude, Trial of Flash, that's where it's at.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we've been sold on that note.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite creative team? A group you'll follow to any series? Tell us about it via our email address, ircb@destroythesybe.org, or shout out your favorite teams on Twitter at ircbpodcast. We're on Tumblr at destroythecyborg, and you can post material and questions over on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by myself, Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Garen Langford and Infinity Shred. You can find more music by Garen Langford on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/garenmusic. You can find more Infinity Shred at infinityshred.bandcamp.com. No matter what type of podcast you're looking for, you can find it, or something close to it, on Twitter via the hashtag PodernFamily. Find a new podcast you didn't know you needed in your life, and support small podcasts like us. Finally, if you like the show, tell someone about it. Rate us online, or write to us. Tell us what you're thinking about comics. And from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
See, but like, okay, I'm going to say, I only because of my most recent bout into Wonder Woman as of this past week. Oh, that's what I should have said I read. I read a fuckload of Wonder Woman this week. That's what I did. I forgot. I read a bunch of Wonder Woman, and like, there were takes of her where I was like, this is fucking awful. I would not want to read this comic about her.
Yeah, no, there's like, a lot of her that's
she's
awful.
Really bland.
Yeah.
And then there are other takes on her character where I'm like, holy shit, this is the coolest fucking story I could ever have imagined. Like, and it's a Wonder Woman story. That's awesome. And then because of that, I'm like, well, who wrote this? And I get really interested in like the creators. But like, I think that like, to what I'm trying to say is I think that can go to like, this can be applied to any major character that has had multiple iterations over the years.
There are certain characters, though, that without really good care, it's hard for them to be anything other than one-dimensional. I think Wonder Woman's definitely one of them, and Daredevil, too. It's so hard for them to be more complex that they have to be in good hands for them to not be that really... Like, Wonder Woman is just, I'm a strong woman. Look at me being a strong female. It's so, like, one-dimensional, which I appreciate that she's a badass woman kicking butt, but that's, like, all she is. She doesn't...
No, well, the comic that I read, which was Sensation Comics number 1, uh-huh. She's also a woman who can't resist window shopping. That was a key point in the story. And had she not been window shopping, she would have not seen the bank next door getting robbed. So, explain that. Yeah. It was actually pretty fucking awful. I just want to
say
that.
What were you reading, Mike?
Okay, so I can give you... So the list that I was reading... Hold on, I've got it in my phone. So for work, we did this thing where I run a comic book club because that's what I fucking do, apparently.
Right.
I started a comic book club that Kate eventually took over, and so we do this thing once a month where we get together and we read comics. And so we started with one week we read the Maggie the Mechanic. That was how I read that, Paul.
Oh, okay. Sure.
So we read Maggie the Mechanic one week. We also read Marvels and Justice in the one week, just because we wanted to get a look at Alex Ross and his take on the two different universes, which is really cool. We also read, we've had like probably half dozen or so of these meetings. So this one week, one of the women in the group, Tia is also in this group. They said, let's read Sensation Comics. Or let's read Wonder Woman comics. And I was like, okay, so I'll go and I'll find a bunch of number ones and like iconic runs, and we'll read just like a various sampling of this character because she's got such a diverse, background, and she's had so many different like introductions to the universe. And I was like, okay, let's just do that. So we read Sensation Comics number 1, Wonder Woman number 1 from 1942, Wonder Woman number 1 from 1987, which is the George Perez run, which was awesome, for me. I love that. That was a really cool number one. The 2006 number one was featuring Donna Troy. Okay. And then the Wonder Woman number 14, which is Gail Simone's start, where Diana Prince, takes the mantle back as Wonder Woman. We also read the Brian Azzarello Wonder Woman number 1 from 2011. The Legend of Wonder Woman number 1, which is like the... I think it's kind of like an all-ages.
That's the all-ages one, yeah.
Yeah. And then we also read Wonder Woman number 195, which I think was Greg Rucka's run of his, like, iconic first arc that he did. So
I didn't know he ever did an arc on Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
I have to look that up.
Oh, yeah. Supposedly, it's like that one and Perez Gail Simone run is the... Yeah. Those are, like, the two really, really important modern takes on that character. But, yeah, so we read a bunch of Wonder Woman, and I was just like, some of it was really, really cool, and it was really interesting. I read them in chronological order because I wanted to see how the other number ones influenced, the subsequent number ones. And it was really funny how, like, characters that were, just dumb throwaway people from the 40s actually became, like, important to the story. Like, there's an issue, or there's a part of Wonder Woman number 1, or maybe a Sensation Comics number 1 where Wonder Woman goes to the circus and she meets this very heavy, like, overweight, like, freak show style woman whose name is Candy
Etta
something.
Candy.
I can't,
Etta Candy. Eta Candy. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and she meets her, and she, like, is like a very small role in the story, but had she not been there, she wouldn't have figured out that, or they wouldn't have been able to dress up as an elephant. Like, that was part of the story. and later that character shows up in Wonder Woman number 1 from 2006, and she's a secret agent who's like trying to figure out who Donna Prince actually is. So it's really cool to see that these characters carry through.
Yeah.
But have you read it all? Super flat. It was so bad. I don't know.
Yeah, no. Sure. Have you read it all about the guy who originally created her and the story?
Oh yeah, there's
there?
all the bondage
implications.
Right,
and how
yeah.
there's like the memos they've like now our public record, whatever, where DC's like, memo, let's dial it back. How about like 40% less bondage? Would be cool.
Oh, yeah. Especially when she gets her lasso and that becomes mm-hmm. like a key part of her character. Back, oh man, he was like all about just like, okay, let's find a reason to tie this woman up. Every yep, single chance that he could time. Take. And so like these old comics had like two or three, like the older ones are like 60 pages long because they had like three comics in one. And it's like every single time there was a chance to bind her or wrap her up in rope, they took it. And it was insane.
And not just like, and they're the BDSM style tie-ups, not like yeah. your normal hostage. It's like, yeah. how did this get printed?
I mean, had I not recognized, had I not seen that before, you know, like I wouldn't mm-hmm. have known, but it's like, holy shit, if you know what it looks like, it's right there in your face. And they constantly did so many shots like of her, like even though she's supposed to be tall and all this stuff, she was always like looked down upon from the perspective mm-hmm. and just very, very subtly sexualized. It was, I couldn't believe it.
Subtly, well, Mike.
I think unless you're looking for it, I don't think it's obvious is what I'm saying.
I don't know. If you handed
that comic to a 9-year old, I don't think they would go, oh, this is true. Really weird. I'm
having feelings I don't understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the creator was also very like, he
believed
very
that women were like stronger than men. Right. And like that female dominated society would be like function much better.
And, yeah. and it was, he was, yeah. I mean, he was involved with early women's liberation movements and stuff. And the lasso of truth, he was also a psychiatrist who helped develop the first lie detector test. So, I mean,
oh, I didn't know that.
All,
that's very
yeah.
interesting.
I mean, it's obviously there's sexual undertones that are pretty obvious, but I think they're not, they're more nuanced or complex than maybe they mm-hmm. appear. So I don't know. It's stuff that's more interesting in theory than to actually read, because reading comics written in the 40s is very, very...
Oh, my gosh.
Very yeah. boring.
Yeah.
And all the guys had that, hey, get out of my way, kid, kind of voice. Like, yeah. they yeah. all... like the intro from last week's episode. I did that for Xander because I told him 2 weeks ago I'd do it as a joke, and then he fucking used it.
That's funny.
I
feel like every time someone says on here, Xander, please cut this, it automatically makes the show. Yeah, automatically.
Not always. There are some things from the early episodes that are never going to make it to air.